This episode of the Robot Report podcast is sponsored by RE Squared Robotics. RE Squared Sapient Intelligent Robotic Arms are designed to improve worker safety and productivity using core technology originally developed by RE Squared Robotics for the U.S. military. RE Squared Sapient systems feature intuitive human-robot control interfaces, outdoor computer vision, and autonomy capabilities. RE Squared Sapien delivers value across a spectrum of outdoor industries, from improving worker safety during aircraft inspections for the aviation industry, to eliminating the hazard of working at height for the construction industry, to keeping workers safe from high voltage hazards for the energy market. To learn more, visit resquared.com/RE2Sapien. That's resquared.com/RE2Sapien. This episode of the Robot Report podcast is brought to you by Futec Advanced Sensor Technology. Futec helps leading innovators shape the future by providing custom sensing and test measurement instruments for groundbreaking applications. Futec solutions push the limits of measurement capabilities and development to reinvent and redefine sensor technology. To learn more, visit Futec.com. Welcome to episode 40 of the Robot Report podcast, which brings conversations with robotics innovators straight to you. I'm Steve Crow, editorial director of the Robot Report. Thanks as always, folks, for tuning in. You can find us on Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, SoundCloud, Spotify, anywhere you get your podcast. Please subscribe, leave us a rating, give us a review. I'm joined now by Mr. Mike Oitzman, the co-host of the program, also editor of our robotics group here at WTWH Media. Mike, how's it going, sir? Turns out we didn't scare you away yet, huh?
Right. Here we go. Yeah. Strapped in and ready to launch.
Ready to rock, baby.
Yeah. Well, hey, so, you know, a quick note here before we get things going. Nominations for the RBR 50 Innovations Program closes next week. It's our annual innovation awards program. It's been around about a decade now. And some of the companies that have won in past years include Agility Robotics, Boston Dynamics, Universal Robots, Waymo. You sort of get the idea. And our editorial team selects the winners. There's no cost to enter. So everyone should be putting in their nomination here. We want to see all those innovative solutions in company practices come through here. So if you think your company belongs on the 2021 list, or if you want to nominate another company, head over to roboticsbusinessreview.com today and enter the 2021 RBR 50 Innovation Awards.
I can't wait to have you initiated into this process. It's you know, we did it. We kind of revamped it last year in a good way, right? Yeah. But it's always fun to have these. You know, we're all, you, Dan, and I are all passionate about certainly different robots, different companies, different technologies. So, whittling down the number of entries to the final 50 is. Have you ever done something like that? It's a fun process.
Only in the context of the buyer's guides last year for the Mobile Robot Guide, where I had awards, if you want to call it that, for innovation and, you know, recommended products. So
anticipate a barrage of emails as to, you know, why said company wasn't on the list. So that's always fun trying to tell folks that what they were working on, you know, just didn't make the cut. That's always a good time. But before we get to our interview, Mike, with RE Squared Robotics, I want to bring this up. There was a tremendous video that resurfaced this week of a South Korean professor who built a self-driving car. I think it was back in it was either 1993 or 1995. So roughly 30 years ago. And this gentleman now, he's a retired professor. He's 79 years old. He built this self-driving car along with some of his students at the university in South Korea and drove it 186 miles across the country. And we have for folks who might not have seen this, it's kind of blowing up on YouTube. I think over a million views at this point, but we have a video, a link to the video in the show notes. We'll post it onto the robotreport.com as well, but the video is fantastic. It's grainy. It looks like it was filmed back in the early 1990s, and the video shows this car barreling down a highway. There's no one behind the steering wheel. He's actually at one point in the back seat waving to the cameras that are in another car filming this autonomous vehicle. You can see there's footage of a 386 chip powered desktop computer, a monitor and a keyboard in the passenger seat. And it's just a tremendous, tremendous video if you guys haven't seen it. And this is kind of the, I don't know if this is like heartbreaking or sad or certainly probably disappointing for him, is the project was actually scrapped at the not too long after that trip, the 186 mile trip happened, as South Korea as a country shifted its focus towards developing their heavy industries, which are tremendous today, the steel industry, the shipbuilding industry. And if you just take a step back and look at all the funding, all the money, all the financial gain that individuals and companies have had by developing autonomous vehicles that really haven't amounted to much of anything at this point. And there he is, you know, he never got the okay, or he was forced to do other things. I wonder if he was ever able to get over that.
Yeah. You know, thanks for sharing the video with me. I think it's a great video, but it looks frightening. The guy's right. sitting in the back seat with no chance to grab the wheel if something goes wrong or step on the brakes.
This was, again, 30 years ago. Yeah. And there's, when Tesla Autopilot first came out, however many years ago it is now, there is similar videos, right, of people, you know, Tesla owners irresponsibly using the autopilot system and sitting in the back seat. Right. This guy did the same thing 30 years ago. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. But, you know, you have to remember that those are the days before AI and machine learning became dominant. Right. So I'm sure that he and his students had written some optimized control code that ran on that laptop rather than some sophisticated machine learning model, which is really how everybody's doing it today. So, you know, technology wise, you know, I think that they proved that the basic bones are capable of doing all that. Yeah. You know, and it's amazing to look at old videos like that. I remember another video I ran into in the last year or two of Brian Carlisle, who was one of the founders of Adept Technology, yep. Sitting on top of the first mobile robot at Stanford from the mid 80s. And I forget the name of the robot, but, you know, sometimes that technology is ahead of its time. And it's fun to look back and see what some of those early pioneers did to make some noise about their inventions.
Yeah, you know, I actually worked on a similar story to the self-driving car, that South Korea professor, a similar story to that about 6 years ago. There was a gentleman named Todd Yockum who went to Carnegie Mellon long time ago. Still works in robotics, but in other aspects, not on autonomous vehicles. And he actually reached out to me about the anniversary of a project he was a part of called the No Hands Across America trip. It was him and one of his colleagues at Carnegie Mellon. They mm-hmm. built an autonomous minivan that drove roughly 3,000 miles, a little less than that, from Washington, D.C. to San Diego, completely autonomous. It cost him $20,000 to retrofit yeah. this awesome 1990 Pontiac Trans Sports minivan. And it's incredible just to see how they were able to pull that off so long ago. They actually kept a journal documenting sort of every step of the trip. They met Jay Leno. You know, Jay Leno's a huge car guy. So I think the end of the trip was, I think they were even on the Tonight Show, if I'm not mistaken. So it's just, yeah. And it's just really, really fascinating to see. And I still hear from that guy once in a while or see him on Twitter, Todd Yockum and one of his colleagues. So it's just, it kind of makes me wonder, like, I'm so fascinated by autonomous vehicles right now, but it makes you wonder, like, you look back again, 25, 30 years here, it makes me wonder how much progress has there really been in this field? Again, certainly more funding, certainly more compute power, different machine learning techniques, as you alluded to, are available today. But some of this stuff was done 30 years ago. And the South Korean professor and others who have since commented on the video since it resurfaced are putting it sort of on par with where Tesla Autopilot is today. Now, that's not me saying that. You know, I don't know. It's sort of a tough to compare, but you know, it really makes me wonder, you know, how far have we come with the billions of dollars that have been poured into this industry? You know, here's this guy and some students who did it in South Korea 30 years ago.
Yeah. Well, I guess I would come back to the whole different technology base now with artificial intelligence, machine learning, and all of that in terms of how they're actually building systems to take the sensor input, react to the sensor input, and make decisions about what happens, right? So that's evolved tremendously in the last 30 years. And, you know, I guess I would ask any of our listeners, if you stumble across any of these videos old videos of robotics from years past. Steve and I'd love to see them. We may even talk about them in a future show, and we'll put a link to this video in the show notes if you haven't seen it. So, go check that out at robotreport.com.
Yeah, we're actually recording this on a Thursday, so sort of a coincidental throwback Thursday.
Mike, very excited about this next conversation. We have probably the three top robotics clusters in the U.S. covered in this conversation. Of course, I'm in Boston. You're out in California. We're joined by two gentlemen leading the way down in Pittsburgh. Jorgen Pedersen, he's the president and CEO of RE Squared Robotics, as well as Travis Schneider, the business development manager of RE Squared Robotics. Gentlemen, thank you for being here. How are things down in Pittsburgh going today?
We're doing well. Thanks for having us on the show.
Yeah, anytime. I haven't been down to Pittsburgh in some time. So I don't actually know if I've ever talked to you guys. It's amazing. I've been doing this for some time. You guys have been around for a while. I don't know if I've ever talked to you guys.
Well, it just speaks to how big the robotics community is now, right?
Right.
I'm kind of ashamed to admit it, but I'm excited for the conversation. And, you know, when I was researching you guys last night to prep for this conversation, Jorgen, it really seems RE Squared has gone through a sort of a dramatic change in its business over the years. And correct me on any of the stuff if I have it wrong, but it looks like you guys started out as a contract engineering firm in the early years. You pivoted to a government R&D contractor, solving their large issues. I read that RE Squared was focused nearly 100% on defense work in 2016. And as of June 2020, was about 70% commercial and 30% defense. And we'll get into what you guys are doing in the new launch of the commercial arms here in a minute. So that number sounds like it's going to change even more. But Jorgen, why the shift in that business model the last few years? And how was that shift gone?
Yeah, so the Defense Department was the early adopter of our technology, which is intelligent mobile manipulation systems. And we've been shipping robotic systems to the Department of Defense ever since 2010 is when we really started shipping product, where we pivoted away from that government R&D and really started shipping product. Then along came 2013, and there was a sequestration, and putting all your eggs in one basket, it became evident that wasn't a good idea. But we weathered that storm, and it was a wake-up call that, you know what, we should really look to diversify beyond just defense. So after bootstrapping the business for 13 years, we did a Series A investment with the mindset of, let's take this military grade technology and start modifying it so that we could enter new commercial markets. And that's exactly what we did. And in 2018 is where we really started to see the traction within the commercial start to take hold. And you were correct in the numbers that you spouted out. And we were lucky that at the time that we really did the major pivot, which is around the 2018 timeframe, and which is why Travis, came aboard to help us with this pivot, was, in that timeframe, we were lucky that we had enough backlog in government funding and opportunity on the defense side to support a pivot. But what was interesting is if I had tried to do that pivot earlier in our career, it might not have worked. But why it worked in 2018 is we had real IP. We could demonstrate capability. And it was over $70 million of government R&D dollars that created some amazing IP. So now we could walk into a corporate boardroom and give a demonstration, not just the PowerPoint presentation. And, it became evident that the world is ready for this capability because we're showing you live what can be done. So that's why we moved, it was sequestration. That was the catalyst that made us think about moving beyond defense. But 2018 is when we really started the pivot. And today that seems to be what's really pulling us forward. We're still going to be doing supporting the defense market because they still have a need for this capability. But there's a cultural shift in the world towards robotics. So we're seeing more and more commercial applications open up for this technology.
government funding's not only been critical, really, I think we've watched it, you know, help be a catalyst for the robotics industry in general. And so thinking back to how companies like iRobot got started as well, I mean, Jürgen, can you give any advice for young startups that are breaking into the market, you know, and considering military work?
Yeah. So we got our start really on the defense side in two ways. One, we were doing contract engineering for the National Robotics Engineering Center of Carnegie Mellon University, and they pulled us into some DARPA programs. And we got a track record and an understanding of how to work in that world. But then I also took some classes on how to win SBIR, Small Business Innovation Research Grants. And I took some classes at the University of Pittsburgh. The CAT school was giving seminars on this. And we took that to heart. We went after an opportunity and we won it. And then all of a sudden, instead of being doing only work for a university in our early years, we were now had a new customer, which was the Department of Defense. And we instantly had $70,000 of revenue coming from the US government. And then we went on to win the phase two. And then the next thing you know, we had $730,000 from the US government. And this is back in the 2006 timeframe, which is a lot of money. So now you have some backlog with a customer that you know is going to pay their bills, that you can trust. And they have a very clearly defined statement of work of what they need. So then you can start hiring up staff and building up a team that can go and own a particular market. So in those early years, we won a phase two SBIR for 700,000. Then we won another one. Next thing you know, you have $1.4 million of revenue coming in the door, and you can really build a business off of that. So we bootstrapped the business by leveraging these SBIR programs that come to you with real needs, introduce you to real customers, and allow you to start building up that network within a new industry. It's the perfect way for an entrepreneur to gain entry to that market in a very welcoming way, because it's hard, you going head to head right out of the gate with a broad agency announcement opportunity, it's going to be really hard for a small business. They don't know how to operate, but the SBIR program almost trains you up on how to work with the government, brings you to a real customer with a real need, and gives you a path to creating product right out of the gate. So that would be, you know, my recommendation of how to get in there. And then also realize, don't do it alone. Learn from others. Partner with those who have already gone through it, or partner with those who are already in that market and build up those relationships, because it's all about camaraderie to gain entry into that market.
So I've got a special interest, a personal interest in what you do, Jürgen. I'm a military dad. My son's a U.S. Marine. He's currently deployed in Okinawa as a diesel mechanic, but he's enamored with re-upping as an explosive ordnance disposal tech. That's sort of one of the glamorous jobs, if you want to call it that, in the military. But as much as I fear for his safety in a role like that, I understand that machines like the robots that you produce help keep EOD techs safe and out of harm's way, and while enabling them to get their effectively do their mission. So can you tell me, as a dad, how are you making it safer for our military and our first responders to get the job done and reduce the risks of the given situation?
Yeah, you picked out a perfect example. Explosive ordnance disposal, one of the most dangerous jobs you can imagine. And no person should be going downrange to interface with an explosive device in today's day. And, you know, so what you're getting to is the why. And the why of this business is to make the world a safer place through robotics. And the way that we're doing that is by creating these intelligent mobile manipulation systems so that you can get people out of harm's way. Don't send them in to do, you may still need the human intellect to perform many of these tasks, but make it so that the robot is the one at the dangerous end of the job. Keep the person safe and remote. And that's exactly what these systems are doing today. You know, our systems are deployed all over the world, helping to save lives. And, you know, I'm proud of that fact that, you know, we're making a positive impact on the world.
So one more sort of business question before we dive into the launch that you guys announced this week. But RE Squared, I was a sophomore in high school when you launched RE Squared back in 2001. And I think I've kind of taken on the moniker of the bearer of bad news in the robotics industry. You know, I've broken too many stories about robotics companies coming and going all the time, right? I know last year you guys grew your staff by nearly 60%. Despite everything that went on with the COVID-19 pandemic, if you can just sort of summarize all the stuff that you just talked about, what are the keys that have kept you guys in business for 20 plus years?
I think it's a combination of things. Perseverance is definitely a attribute that you need to have. But I think it's a combination of, first, we bootstrap. Not many companies do that anymore. Most people go out, raise money, go hit it hard and hope that they are, you know, in that a small percentage that hits it out of the park. Whereas we incrementally built out over time and built up capability and have slowly grown this business, slowly and steadily, with growing our IP, growing our staff of people. And then along the way, learning, right? As I talked about before, diversifying, so you bring stability. But I think along the way, the common thread from day one, and is what I think makes our company strong, is a focus on people. I truly believe if you take care of people, everything else works itself out, right? You'll have technical success. You'll have innovation. You'll deliver amazing products. You'll have impact. You'll have profitability and growth. By focusing on the people, they're happy. And when people are happy, they do amazing things. And they work together. So finding the right group of people that want to innovate and create together, I think is what has been our secret sauce for the past two decades.
Easier said than done, though.
Yeah.
And build that team. I mean.
Absolutely. And we haven't gotten it perfect along the way, I'll tell you that. But we do learn from our mistakes. And more recently, we even just revamped our entire interview process that focuses more on finding people that align with our core values than being the best engineer in the world, for example, right? Because how you interact with the people around you and the way that you work is more important sometimes than the technical output. So that's why and like I said, we haven't got it right, every time, but that is our focus, and it's generated a good recipe for success and growth.
And I think bootstrapping is clearly admirable in terms of getting to where you've gotten and being successful and staying afloat. So kudos for that aspect of the story. But hey, so we're curious and anxious to hear about the new product launch. So I think this last week you guys have launched your new Sapien line of robot arms. So Travis, can you give us an overview of the new product and what it does and how it works?
Yeah, I'd love to. And I'll start by saying we're just really excited about this launch. So ultimately, this is really the culmination of about 20 years of development and frankly, evolution of our technological nuggets that we've been refining over the years. So basically, the Sapien line is a set of manipulators that have been purposely designed for mobile applications really from the ground up, which is very different, obviously, than many of the industrial manipulators in the market today, whose purposes are typically intended for like in-factory applications in like an automotive environment. So some attributes that make, you know, our series of manipulators ideal for mobile applications kind of start with, first, our superior strength to weight ratios. So this means for like given a given payload, these manipulators are often smaller and lighter weight than what you would commonly find across kind of the industrial counterparts, meaning that at a system level, the system will also be smaller. So a smaller manipulator will translate to either, you know, a smaller mobility platform in some cases, or might also translate to extended range of operation on on say a fixed power supply, like a battery bank. Second, you know, these manipulators are rugged. They are designed and intended to be exposed to the outdoor environment. So we're intending for these manipulators to be exposed to rain, snow, salt fog, you name it, even submerged in water in some cases. So we don't need, you know, umbrellas. We don't need to put covers over these manipulators. They're intended to be exposed to the environment. Third would be, you know, they fit a very compact form factor and can fit within a very constrained infrastructure. So again, kind of comparing and contrasting to say an industrial manipulator that's conducting a task kind of at the edge of what I'd call human capability. Oftentimes that industrial manipulator would take up a sizable footprint, oftentimes a footprint greater than the size of a human, whereas our technology typically fits within the confines of the human form. And the last bullet point that I'll hit on here is that we're optimized around low voltage operation. Oftentimes this is, you know, a great pairing for, you know, battery powered operation. So it's the combination of all these attributes that, as well as our, you know, dexterous robots that deliver true human-like capability, you know, as the name implies, which make these manipulators ideal for a wide range of outdoor applications, you know, ranging from agriculture to aviation to construction, energy, you know, the list goes on from that standpoint.
Travis, can you maybe, again, this is an audio experience. Can you maybe just describe what the machine looks like? You know, what is it for folks that may have never seen your equipment before?
I mean, so from a form factor standpoint, it'll look like a robotic arm. It's just that it's much more power optimized and strength optimized in its form factor, right? So it'll classically look like a typical robotic arm, but it's just much more capable. And that's due to just a lot of good engineering and a lot of good know-how. Leading to our 20 years of experience in developing highly capable manipulators for explosive ordnance disposal, it's led us to develop a highly optimized joint technology. It's kind of the baseline technology for our robotic manipulators.
And for the listeners who want to learn more, we have a link in the show notes here to more coverage on the Robot Report about the launch of the Sapien arm. So if you want to see some great images and more about the specs, just check out the links in the show notes. Jorgen, going back to the military days for you guys, I think these arms were originally developed for the military. Now you've adapted them to be more of a commercial solution for aviation, construction, energy, medical, and other markets. Can you just take us inside, you know, some of those changes, Jorgen, some of those modifications that RE Squared made to the arms to make them more appropriate for commercial applications?
Since the DoD, the Department of Defense, was the early adopter of our technology, we often had to comply with very stringent requirements called MIL standard or MIL spec. And these standards essentially require any product to work in almost any environment on the planet, because that's where the military operates, you know, ranging from Arctic conditions to high humidity jungle conditions to arid hot desert conditions. They required operation in any weather condition. They required to be able to withstand shock and vibration and even withstand things like bleach washdown. So as we modified our technology for commercial use, we were able to relax, not eliminate, but relax these requirements, which allowed us to reduce costs. Additionally, for the military, they require ultra lightweight solutions, since personnel often needed to carry these robots around. By allowing the system to be even a few pounds heavier, we were able to significantly address reduction in costs. So in the end, we've still retained that lightweight, compact, dexterous, strong, power efficient, and rugged human-like package, now all in one affordable package.
Travis, can you maybe share an example of how you envision the Sapien arms are going to be used commercially?
Sure, yeah. I can point to, frankly, a recent example of a project that we were recently awarded through the U.S. Department of Energy, not the DOD, but the DOE, the Solar Energy Technology Office, that's frankly been getting a lot of attention recently. We refer to this program as OAMP, which stands for Outdoor Autonomous Manipulation of Photovoltaic Panels. But OAMP is a lot easier to say. So here we're focused on really optimizing the flow of solar modules from delivery to installation for utility scale power plants. So OAMP will basically combine the capability of our Sapien series manipulator, our computer vision capabilities, and artificial intelligence to autonomously and safely manipulate these modules from their packaging to installation in solar racking systems. And that, frankly, I think this is a great application story for the numerous benefits it'll provide humans. First, you know, starting with the photovoltaic panels themselves. So they're frankly, they're really heavy and awkward to manipulate. They measure, 2 meters by 1 meter. They weigh anywhere from 55 pounds to 75 pounds each. And a given plant might have hundreds of thousands of these modules, depending upon the size of the solar plant. And what a lot of people don't realize is this work is done entirely manually today. It's extremely arduous. Workers are exposed to a lot of repetitive strain issues in trying to manipulate those, again, those large, heavy, awkward modules. And given kind of the magnitude of the work in terms of the scale and also the competition for these large solar projects, these workers are challenged to move as fast as possible. So inevitably, this leads to a lot of quality issues, a lot of repetitive strain issues. So this might translate to cracked modules, modules being placed backwards, et cetera. So OAMP will basically be an assistive device to these workers, helping them to move faster with better quality and alleviating a lot of those strain issues. The second benefit this system will provide is that increase in speed and efficiency will contribute directly to the bottom line of these projects. So for people that are investing in these solar plants, like solar developers, it'll improve their profitability in these projects. And then third, and probably one of the most important items here is it'll improve access to renewable power for society. So by lowering the cost of solar, more people will be able to access, clean power. So we view this as a real kind of win-win-win for the Sapien series.
Just a follow-up, if I may. I don't find myself too often on a solar field. Okay.
Sure.
Interestingly, our parent media company actually owns a media brand called Solar Power World, and I don't often see them writing about robotics. I know there in the past there have been some robotic solutions to clean the panels, I believe, but just in general, is there a lot of robotics work being done on solar fields? I would think not. So it seems like somewhat of a novel application or market for robotics.
Yeah. So a couple things there. So actually Solar Power World was kind enough to feature a press release kind of announcing the unveiling of this system. So thank you to that team for featuring our press release. But to your question around, basically, is there precedence for robotic systems or autonomous systems to produce solar farms? I will say yes and no. So there have been previous attempts at, I'll call it more hard automation in terms of the physical construction of power plants or solar plants, but a lot of these relied upon, I'll call it proprietary hardware, proprietary like curbing systems, but they kind of, a lot of them fell flat from the standpoint that they were bucking the system from the perspective of the wider solar supply chain, right? So the solar industry has long worked to kind of optimize the cost of not only photovoltaics, but also like racking system hardware and a wide variety of those other components. Well, previous attempts have really focused in on leveraging really proprietary hardware that didn't take advantage of, I'll just generally refer to the economies of scale of the photovoltaic supply chain. Whereas our iteration of OAMP is focused on leveraging, again, AI and computer vision to adapt to those components that already exist within the PV supply chain. So we're not looking to kind of buck the system. We're looking leverage the intelligence and capability of our robotic system to simply adapt to existing components.
Oh, that's very cool. I think so. Part of what I think you're hitting on there is autonomy. And Jorgen, I know this has been a big focus of RE Squared recently, is to add more autonomy to its systems. I guess why was the decision to make, you know, to do that now? It seemed like things were going quite well for you guys with just the teleoperation capabilities. But why are you guys now focusing on adding more autonomy to the systems here?
Yeah, well, I think the best way to answer that is maybe just rewinding back to, once again, you know, the early adopter was military. And going back to that example we gave before of explosive ordnance disposal, where you're going to defuse a roadside IED, because they were improvised, they were also often never the same, meaning that you couldn't really address them in a standard way or in an autonomous manner. Rather, you needed a human in the loop, and you needed that human intellect to investigate and determine how to render the device safe. As a result, the goal was to allow an operator to control a robot from a safe distance as if the robot was an extension of him or herself. This capability naturally ported to certain commercial applications, such as, you know, cleanup activities at Fukushima. But what we're experiencing now is a cultural shift towards the acceptance of robotics for non-traditional use cases. You know, moreover, we're seeing an increasing shortage of skilled labor across multiple markets, such as construction, agriculture, energy, and aviation. And I think the main reason why markets like this are now open to using robotics is that, one, we're past, you know, I said again, we're past the PowerPoint stage. We can demonstrate firsthand what these human-like, you know, sapient robots can do. And these markets all have one thing in common. They're controlled environments. They're not open to the general public, where only skilled workers are in the area. This means that you can safely introduce this capability to the market. And, you know, when we talk about autonomy, just one thing to add there, we're talking about a spectrum. On one end, you have one person overseeing almost every action. You know, maybe they're not directly controlling it, but they're overseeing and are heavily involved in whatever action is being performed. On the other hand of the spectrum, you have no one involved, right? There, it's a completely autonomous solution. And by the way, I don't think anyone's actually at that end of the spectrum yet. But where most systems reside is in this middle zone. And what I call it is like this supervised autonomy zone. And I think we're gonna be in this zone for the foreseeable future. And in this zone, in the supervised autonomy zone, a skilled worker with years of experience can oversee a system of robots, amplifying that person's knowledge and allowing that person to work longer in his or her career, because now you're just putting the brawn on the robot. So this is a very powerful way to think about how work is going to change and how we're going to continue to grow as a society by having robots and humans working together. And, you know, but at the bottom line, I think it's this shortage of skilled labor that's really driving the now.
Just a follow-up on that, if I may. Supervised autonomy, human in the loop, you know, there's a couple of terms that I've heard. And I feel like not all robotics engineers are on board with that. You know, I've talked to many who embrace supervised autonomy or embrace human in the loop, but there's others who, you know, I don't know if they try to over-engineer things or they don't want to admit that their solutions don't work 100% of the time. I think that's very unrealistic, like you were saying. But do you feel like everybody's on board with that? Is there sort of a battle between those terms amongst other robotics engineers, or are people pretty accepting of, you know, admitting that there's a need for a supervised autonomy?
No, I think that there is a battle, right? There's always a difference of opinions. I'm always of the standpoint that I will never put my ethics on a shelf and introduce robots into the world if there's ever a chance that I feel that they could truly harm someone. You know, the second you take robots and put them into the general public, you're putting them into around humans, which are unpredictable, right? And that unpredictability is what makes it hard for certain robots beyond a Roomba, where the worst you do is stub your toe,
Autonomous vehicles is a good example, not to go down that rabbit hole, but
And I don't want to single out any one market or, you know, but in generality, right, I think there's plenty of opportunity for robots to make a positive impact on this world by entering those controlled environments where you can ensure safety at a level beyond in the general, general public.
Right.
And, so that's the way I think about it. Others clearly are pushing the envelope and trying to get into that, fully autonomous state. And that's good. It's going to move the needle. But I think in the end, I think we're just going to see that we've moved the needle, but it's still going to be a long time before we truly see the level of autonomy that some people are pushing toward.
So Travis, what do you think have been some of the challenges that you guys have experienced in increasing the level of autonomy in, over the last couple of years?
Sure. So I'd say one of the bigger challenges that we've encountered as we begin to get more of our autonomous solutions out to the market is how it has to kind of change the customer's mindset and changing in the way that they kind of do work. So what I mean by that is it means that they have to change some of their operating procedures because this is introducing a new element to their work procedures. So oftentimes our customers have, standard operating procedures or kind of leaned out workflows. But once you integrate a robot to that whole scenario, it requires kind of a different way of thinking. But oftentimes it isn't necessarily seen as an impediment because we're solving, oftentimes productivity issues for our customers, but it just requires a new way of thinking. So I don't know that it's necessarily been a huge challenge, but it's definitely been one that we've had to work hand in hand with a lot of our customers to try to resolve.
And so teleoperations still going to remain a core part of your functional capabilities?
Yeah, that's correct. Much like Jürgen was alluding to, teleoperation is not going away. Mm-hmm. There's always going to be those edge cases. The world is a very complex place. There's a number of applications that will still require, direct human supervision for at least, like Jürgen was saying, the foreseeable future here. Explosive ordnance disposal is, obviously one application we've already covered, but there's a variety of other applications that we're encountering that are either very complex or very critical in nature that are going to require human intellect. A classic example is surgical robots. We're supporting a major medical company producing a surgical robot where the surgeon's still at the helm of the robot. But the robot is there to help improve speed and quality of their work. Another example that comes to mind is electrical line maintenance. So for any of those who are familiar with line work, these people are exposing themselves to not only the hazard of working at height, but also the hazard of working in close proximity to live exposed conductors operating at, potentially tens, if not hundreds of thousands of volts. Mm-hmm. So not only, is there an opportunity for the robot to, potentially like do something like blow a fuse, but if a robot performs the wrong action on the grid, that would impact, potentially thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people by taking out a major portion of the grid. So I also believe that, human supervision will likely always be required to kind of interpret what actions the robot might make on the circuit at large.
Talking with Jürgen Pedersen, president and CEO of RE Squared Robotics, and Travis Schneider, the business development manager of RE Squared Robotics. Travis, just sticking with the autonomy capabilities here, I believe RE Squared is a proponent of open source, right? In ROS, using ROS. What can you tell us about how the perception in autonomy teams are training these systems? Are you relying on any sort of available data sets? Are you creating your own? What can you tell us about the training aspect of this?
Sure. Yeah. And this would be a great opportunity for actually one of our principal research scientists
Amanda, right? Where's Amanda?
Dr. Amanda Sproy, to come in. She's talked at length about this in a couple of different series already. And the phrase she always brings up, and I'll reiterate it here, is data is king. So oftentimes we're gathering just tremendous, tremendous amounts of data to ensure reliable performance of our systems. But, you know, given the nature of our applications, we're working on a lot of perception problems outdoors. Frankly, there aren't a lot of open data sets for the types of things that we're focused in on. So more often than not, we're creating our own data in a lot of the applications that we're serving today. That's probably just more the nature of kind of our area, because there's not a lot of people focused on outdoor perception problems, at least in a lot of our verticals. But over time, there might be more of those that become available.
So there's another interesting area that you apply your solutions, and that's one if by land, two if by sea. So RE Squared has announced its maritime dextrous manipulation system, which was originally developed for U.S. Navy applications, and I think you're getting ready to productize that commercially as your RE Squared Sapien C-class arms. So similar to the first question about the Sapien arms, Jürgen, how did you modify this system for commercial availability?
The beautiful part about our Sapien C-class arms is that they're being integrated with underwater vehicle manufacturers such as Teledyne, such as VideoRay. Mm-hmm. And those corporations also support both military and commercial customers. And in other words, as soon as we integrated our Sapien C-class arms with an ROV for a defense application, we could immediately apply it to the commercial sector. So once again, you know, we can just like our terrestrial solutions, there's certain requirements that we can relax for commercial use that allow us to develop less expensive variants. But for the most part, it's still that same rugged human-like package that applies to multiple markets.
So I'm seeing a pattern here that based on your experience and the way that you've built your business, I mean, going from military to commercial seems like the more straightforward path, because anything you build for the military is going to be robust enough for commercial, but not necessarily the other way around.
That's right. I'm glad that we've picked the direction that we are following now versus the reverse.
Good. Yeah.
I love, you know, the whole maritime robotics industry. I know there was a subsea, you know, autonomous underwater vessel company, Bedrock Robotics, I think received some funding last week. We recently had, and this was one of my favorite conversations I've ever had on this podcast, we had two former Marines on the podcast late last year tell us about their startups journey developing autonomous submarines, again, for deep ocean exploration. I think their long-term goal, a pretty lofty one, but kudos to them, is to build the Google Earth of the ocean, which is a fascinating idea because we know such little information about our oceans. Jürgen, can you talk about just some of the challenges of operating your systems underwater? I would imagine operating depth and sealing the systems for the water in corrosion are probably two of the bigger issues.
Yeah, there's a lot to overcome when you go underwater. Yeah, I mean, let's start there. You're in water, right? We have electromechanical robotic arms operating underwater. Then not only is it just water, but it's corrosive. It's salt water.
Right.
It eats away at most materials that you put underwater. Then, you know, when we're looking at Navy applications or even commercial for that matter, they want to go deeper. They, you know, you're going to significant depths underwater. And as you do, you start increasing pressure. Luckily, our Sapien C-class features, you know, a clever design that keeps our arms equalized in pressure no matter what depth we're going to. And then, you know, so, you know, that's just the, hey, you're in water and you're going deep. But then there's the operational side of it too. You're in, the oceans are not always this nice, calm environment. you have varying sea state levels, and you have currents both above water and at different levels below the surface. And that can affect vehicle stability, which then, you know, if you're trying to do autonomy underwater and your world is constantly swaying or moving, even slightly or vigorously, that you have to be able to account for that. Then you add in turbidity, right? Sometimes you can't really see. If you're in a port, it may be some pretty murky waters because things are getting churned up, which makes it hard from a computer vision standpoint. And then when you start thinking about going deep, you have to deal with, sometimes you can have a tether, right? If you're doing an ROV, remote operated vehicle, but if you're doing more autonomous operations, you want to break that tether and have an autonomous underwater vehicle or AUV. And then now you have to put so much intelligence and thinking on the robot itself because you have limited bandwidth to the surface. You know, acoustic modems typically are not able to, you're not able to ship a lot of data over acoustic modems. So these are all the challenges that we were presented with. But we've overcome them in the last few years, and have really high quality solutions for the underwater environment.
Right. So we've talked about some interesting applications and markets that RE Squared's been involved with over the last couple of years, and a lot of fascinating projects. So Jürgen and Travis, what are some of the projects you're most proud of?
Well, maybe I'll jump in first and then I'll let Travis give his thoughts too. But, just to follow on that underwater system, I think, one of the challenges we have, we work with a lot of commercial customers and we can't talk about everything we're doing right now.
Come on.
There's a lot I'm proud of. But, going to that Sapien C class, we're a completely terrestrial company making robotic arms for land. And in a 1 year period, we went from having zero experience underwater to having demonstrated tremendous proficiency in underwater robotics at levels that were better than most who have already been in that space for decades, right? And then a year later, not only did we demonstrate, hey, we can make robots that function underwater, even from a teleop standpoint. But then a year later, we demonstrated computer vision-based autonomy of the Sapien C class arms underwater, which was just, that's makes it clear to me that we have some of the best robotics engineers and scientists in the world that can go from ground zero to being one of the best out there in terms of providing a new capability underwater and leapfrogging people that have been in that space for years. So I'm really proud of the people that I work with.
Just jumping in with perhaps maybe another good feel-good story here. So one, application that certainly makes me proud of, the organization that I work for was an application where we delivered a set of robotic arms to the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant to support remediation in that facility. So here again, leveraging basically our core technology that was used for explosive ordnance disposal and keeping, operators out of harm's way, just in a different application here. So instead of keeping operators out of harm's way from an explosive device here, we're keeping personnel safe from, harsh radiation. Right. So the system was delivered in 2018. Still going strong. Here we are providing or projecting really human-like capability, again, in an environment where, people frankly can't go. So the robot is currently being used to, pick up pieces and parts that are, strewn throughout the plant. Again, here's a good example of teleoperation. So it's controlled via teleoperation by an operator who's, tucked away safely from the harsh effects of radiation. So I think this is just another good shining example of how, robots can truly be used as a force for the good of humanity.
I find that's very interesting, Travis. Just a curious question that I have, and maybe a lot of our listeners have as well. I mean, you send a robot into a nuclear facility that's radioactive. Can you reuse that robot after that, or does it destroyed in some way as a part of that?
Yeah, I don't know that I'm the best person to answer that question. I would imagine there's elements of it that become irradiated after prolonged exposure. So I would imagine that at the end of its use, it's probably going to have to be scrapped, much like other sort of materials would be.
Being the robot nerd, maybe my best analogy would be like Wally is cleaning up everything around him. And then the last thing he does is he puts himself into the trash heap as well. And
right.
That's a great analogy. Well, hey, this has been a great conversation, you guys. Well, Mike and I will have to come down to Pittsburgh when all this fun stuff with COVID ends. It looks like it's nearing the end here. Hopefully we'll get some of those stories out of you, Jürgen, about some other stuff you've worked on. But best of luck with the Sapien launch. Wish you guys nothing but the best there. And let's not wait 10 years. I've been doing this for 10 years. Let's not wait 10 years till we talk again. Jürgen Pedersen, President and CEO of RE Squared Robotics, and Travis Schneider, Business Development Manager of RE Squared Robotics. Gentlemen, thanks so much, and best of luck again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mike, if I'm starting a robotics company based on what we just heard there, sounds like initially focusing on military and defense applications, not a terrible idea.
Yeah, well, you know, Steve, it's no secret that starting a robotics company is hard. Many of our listeners, I'm sure, are in the midst of all that right now. But, you know, starting with a customer like the Department of Defense or the Department of Energy, as we learned, you know, can be a great way to finance those first couple generations of a product and then think about commercializing the technology for, you know, the general market after that. I mean, RE Squared certainly proves that model. And I just love the story about how they bootstrapped the company to get into this point in their history.
Are they going SPAC? Are they another SPAC, which we'll talk about? Probably not. Doesn't sound like it. But again, RE Squared also introduced, as we talked about in the interview there, the commercial version of its Sapien arms this week. We have a link to that, our coverage in the show notes, if you want to learn more about how they took the RE2 arms that were originally designed for the military and commercialized them for other industries, or you can check out RE Squared Robotics at resquared.com.
Time now for the engineering tip of the week, brought to you by Futech Advanced Sensor Technology. Futech helps robotics innovators like NASA and the world's leading med tech companies shape the future by providing custom sensing and test measurement solutions for groundbreaking applications. In this week's tip, Futech's Vice President Naveed Mockberry will give you the scoop on what sensor to use to improve robotic performance.
If you're a diehard fan of robotic engineering like us, you're probably also constantly on the lookout for new and innovative ways to optimize robotic performance. And if you're an engineer, you're likely familiar with 6 degrees of freedom sensors and how they help ensure high precision movement in robotic applications. But what you probably don't know is that there's an alternative to the 6 degrees of freedom sensors that is actually superior. We at Futech are always striving to improve and innovate on existing sensor technology, and we were frustrated with some of the limitations of the 6 degrees of freedom sensor. That's why we have designed and built a proprietary strain wave gear torque sensor that offers the same high precision capabilities for closed loop feedback as the 6 degrees of freedom sensor, but it also has a lot of other benefits. For example, one problem with 6 degrees of freedom sensors is that even if just one channel is malfunctioning in an application, you have to replace them all. That can get very expensive. But the strain wave gear torque sensor has a single channel per joint, which means that it can be serviced and replaced without impacting the other sensors. That makes it both easier and much more cost-effective to install and maintain. Another advantage is that there's a lot less room for error during implementation, as it can be customized with dual channels for redundancy and safety. It also has flexibility on custom geometry for embedded electronics with fault detection. All of this means that the strain wave gear sensor has a much shorter learning curve, saves you time and resources during installment, and ultimately has a lower cost of ownership. To learn more about Futech's proprietary strain wave gear torque sensors, go to futech.com.
Let's turn our attention now to the news, Mike, and to stay updated on all the latest robotics news, we have you covered with our network of robotics sites. Make sure you guys check out the Robot Report, Robotics Business Review, and Collaborative Robotics Trends. Mike, I always like to start with an update on the Mars 2020 mission as much as possible. And there was a couple major milestones this week when it comes to the Ingenuity helicopter. First touchdown on the surface of Mars on April 4th. And earlier today, actually, its two rotor blades were unlocked, and they actually conducted and successfully conducted a slow speed test for the first time. And keep in mind, first time this has ever been done on another planet, as far as we know. There's probably a lot we don't know about what's going on out in outer space. But if the tests continue to go well, NASA says the first attempted flight for Ingenuity will happen no later than this Sunday. It was actually supposed to happen at some point today, but they pushed it back a few days here. And Mike, that's going to be a tough one for me. I got to be honest, this is a major interest to me. Space robotics, as we've talked about on the podcast a bunch. So Sunday is also the final round of the Masters. No Tiger Woods this year, of course, but the final round of the Masters, one of the best days of the year for a sports nut like me. So I think I'm going to give you the job of keeping an eye on how things are going with Ingenuity this weekend, if that's fine by you.
You bet. Well, you know, and I think that watching the helicopter unfurl from the belly of Perseverance was probably the world's, the universe's slowest time lapse.
No kidding, huh?
One leg at a time, what, you know, then dropped it off. I mean, they're being very deliberate with every action here as they get that thing set up to do its test flight this weekend. So certainly a lot of folks will be watching and see what happens. It's going to be an interesting moment in history.
Yeah, I don't know if do people understand the gravity of that, of the situation here. You know, I mean, come back to the RBR-50, and we've discussed this briefly a couple of weeks ago. You know, talk about they should definitely be an RBR-50 company, right? Is it NASA? Is it JPL? The combination of the two. But what's more innovative than sending, you know, not only a rover, but now a drone helicopter hundreds of millions of miles away flawlessly? There's been no major, you know, troubles. Yes, they delayed Ingenuity a couple of days here, but just a tremendous engineering feat that, if this all goes well on Sunday, could really change the future of space exploration. So I don't think, you know, maybe you and I and others in robotics sort of understand that because we're much closer to it than, you know, the general public, but this is a potentially a historic moment for the future of space exploration.
Yeah. Back to your original point before the interview today about, you know, how does a company do something to innovate and then take it public from a commercial standpoint? And again, you know, a lot of this technology that we're seeing here is going to find its way into everyday products and ultimately into, you know, robotic solutions that are, you know, going to get deployed in industry somewhere down the road.
Yeah, we have complete coverage of the Mars 2020 mission and all the updates that are going on there. You'll find it on the homepage at therobotreport.com. Moving on here, Mike, we got to start a SPAC. Do you know anything about starting SPACs?
I can't say that I know anything about starting SPACs, but it seems like, you know, it's certainly everything is SPAC crazy, right?
I don't even know if that's, yeah, maybe starting a SPAC is not even the right word. Just we got to figure this out. I'm not getting any younger. You're not getting any younger. And the craze continued this week. RBR50 company Sarcos Robotics, we know those guys quite well, announced it's going public via a SPAC. The new company, valued at $1.3 billion, the combined company will be known as Sarcos Technologies and Robotics Corporation, expected to trade on the NASDAQ under the ticker symbol STRC. There's been a couple of other SPACs in robotics, you know, hardware-specific robotics. Berkshire Grey, SoftBank announced one. There's also five LiDAR companies that have already gone public via SPAC: Ava, Innovus, Luminar, Ooster, Innovus. Hopefully I'm pronouncing all those guys right. And then there's one that's still pending, AI. Their SPAC is still pending. And, you know, we had, prior to you joining, we had someone on the podcast that tried explaining this whole thing to me, and it just kind of went over my head. So I fully don't understand. I understand that it's easier. There's less hurdles to get over compared to an IPO. But what do you think about this whole craze entering the robotics realm?
I think this is fodder for a future podcast. We need to come back and take a deeper look at this. And again, you know, starting a robot company takes a lot of capital, right? To build hardware, get it prepared. So You know, this is just one more way. I mean, all of these companies are hardware companies, of course, and the trend that you also described in terms of all of the LiDAR companies. So, you know, those companies are trying to capitalize and raise the money to get them to the next level of growth. So definitely an interesting trend to watch, right?
I guess a big part of this, you know, in going public, I think back to the conversation I had with Locus maybe a couple of months ago now, where they raised that $150 million late stage round. And they told me that their next step is to go public, right? So if they have to raise another round of funding, they're going to probably do that via an IPO. So certainly there's that aspect here. Berkshire Grey, all these LiDAR companies, Sarcos has tremendous access now to additional capital. Certainly the owners of these companies respectively probably have a lot of financial gain, you know, in making this decision as well. And I don't fault them for making those decisions at all. I would probably do the same thing. I think it's just going to be interesting to see, you know, how some of these SPACs work out. I'm guessing, and again, this is just a guess, I'm guessing there's going to be a lot of them that probably don't work out, as just being the structure of a public company and the challenges that come with that. Most of these companies, especially those LiDAR companies we mentioned, are pretty young companies. Mm-hmm. You know, are they prepared for all that comes with being a public company and dealing with all that kind of stuff? The one that I'm probably the most confident in being successful is Sarcos. I mean, they've been around for a very long time. Ben Wolf, who I know pretty well, talked to several times over the years. You know, he's sold companies for, there's one in particular, I forget the name of the company and who he sold it to, but he sold it for billions of dollars years ago. And he probably has some of the most experience with this kind of stuff. But I just wonder if these companies are really ready to deal with all the things that comes with being a public company.
You got to have a real product and you have to have a real market to be successful as a public company, as you do with any other company. But certainly once you're public, you can't hide anything, right? So that's,
yeah. And there's, you know, speaking of hiding anything, I'm not saying any of these companies in the robotics industry are hiding anything. There was an interesting article recently in Bloomberg about an electric vehicle company called Canoe that's going public. And, you know, one of the, I don't know if loophole is the right word for the SPAC, is that you can, a lot of this, the valuation and the funding and all that the money raised is based off sort of loosey goosey future revenue projections, right? And, you know, once this company merged with the SPAC, it kind of fell apart, right? I mean, all the curtains were, you know, behind the curtains, and some of the financial picture wasn't as rosy as they had made it seem to be, right? Yeah. So it's just, you wonder, what's the role? Is that a similar thing that's going to happen to some of these robotics companies? I think to, you know, the co-founder of Cruise, the self-driving vehicle company, he wrote a piece about, and we sort of summarized it on the Robot Report, just his thoughts on what's going on with the LiDAR companies. And, you know, he was saying inevitably, all of this is going to lead to consolidation. And maybe that would have happened anyway, mm-hmm. but he really broke down sort of comparing, you know, who the target markets are, the target customers, the target markets for all of these LiDAR companies that have gone public via SPAC. And there was just so much overlap with who their potential customer base is. He was like, inevitably it's all going to fall down. So I think you're right. You know, I think we should probably dig deeper into this and see what this all means, where this is going. I know SPACs were big a few decades ago, and it's sort of come back into the limelight here, much, much bigger than it was a couple of decades ago. But is it a cyclical thing? You know, the economy's doing pretty well right now. Does that have part, you know, it's probably a big part of this as well. So yeah, I think you're right. We probably should dive deeper into this.
Yeah. And there's a reason, as we saw with WeWork in the last two years, right, that there's a vetting process that goes on in going public, and it's meant to you know, expose companies like WeWork that didn't have everything lined up to go public, right?
Right. So if anybody out there, you know, some of you know who you are, who are listening to this, if you want to come on and help us out navigate this SPAC craze and break it down and what it means for the future of the robotics industry, you know, reach out to Mike or myself, and we'll try to get you on the program here in the next couple of weeks. One final thing, Mike, before we go, Auto Motors just introduced a new version of their heavy duty AMR. They're calling it the Auto 1500 V2. I think the first one was introduced, 2015. Heavy duty AMRs, we wrote about this maybe a year or two ago. Certainly a recent trend, I would say, in the autonomous mobile robot space, but Auto Motors certainly was probably one of the earlier to the game in this type of product.
Yeah, and I just covered the story that they've upped the payload to 1,900 kilograms. So I'm still calling it the 1,500. So there's a little bit of extra room in there for the weight on the actual payload in terms of what it's carrying. And then the other thing that I want to give them kudos for is enhancing the payload interface. So there's additional capabilities to interface to whatever's riding on top of it. And they've improved the power takeoff, made that easier. And I think that's all an indication of the importance that the machine builders are given to integrators to make these platforms more accessible, easier to integrate with, the add-ons. And there's a whole, sub-market now that's building add-ons for all these different robots. And so I think it's a great sign of where the market's headed.
Why wouldn't they change the name?
I don't know.
It just seems like that's always what you do, especially with the AMRs. It's, the model number often relates to the payload capacity, right?
Well, they're still saying that the actual cargo payload should be 1500. It gives you about 400 kilograms in whatever, payload you build on top of it. So,
and certainly this is in anticipation of next week's ProMat event, which I'm looking forward to. I know you are as well. What are you expecting to see from there? You and I have heard from many different mobile robotics companies that will be showing off new products. Some of them we can't talk about yet. We'll certainly have in-depth coverage of some of them coming next week. But what are you looking forward to as far as ProMat goes?
Well, the conversations I think are going to be around some new products, but mostly around, what's the market need now? The advent of e-commerce has put a lot of pressure on all the material handling companies, and that's what that show's about. So they're all going to be talking about ways that they can help customers improve their efficiency and throughput. That's probably going to be a big thread about every solution. They're trying to wrap things up into nice big packages that are functional end to end, right?
Yeah, I'm interested really in the logistics of this event itself, to be quite honest with you. There's events companies, we have our own virtual, events that have been shifted to being online due to COVID-19. And a lot of these events that have the exhibition part of it, a digital exhibition part of it, the engagement is tough from the exhibitor standpoint. But I've heard good things about this one. I've heard good things about how they have gone about setting this up and trying to get the exhibitors some actual time to promote and get all the eyeballs on them. It's not just about the conference, and they have a tremendous conference lined up as well, but they're actually really trying to put in the time and the effort and the resources to make sure that the exhibitors get bang for their buck. I've heard, this is going back a few months ago, I heard from a few of their sponsors who were excited about the format of this event. So, that's what kind of excites me. I mean, the virtual show / booth idea is a tough one to pull off. And so I'm excited just to check that out.
There's been a lot of angst from a lot of vendors over the last year about how, all of these digital events have evolved and the normal sort of serendipity interaction that you get as you walk through a trade show. We all sort of miss that. I think we lamented on that, related to how CES went down earlier in the year, which is, an event where serendipity is, critical to finding cool new stuff. Maybe not so much in an industry like material handling, but at the same time, it's all those, conversations you have with folks waiting in line to get lunch and waiting in line to, outside.
Drinking the terrible coffee.
Right, exactly. So, I think we're all anxious to, as much as we like to beat up on those events, we still sort of miss that interaction.
It's a very hard thing to pull off these digital events. But I remember reading articles about, in-person events are dead. And it's like, that can't be any farther from the truth. So, I'm with you, man. Definitely looking forward to getting back to the in-person events. Whenever that happens later this year, next year, it'll be fun.
Again, folks, to stay updated on all the latest robotics news, we have you covered with our network of robotics sites. Make sure you check us out at The Robot Report, Robotics Business Review, and Collaborative Robotics Trends. And that's going to do it for episode 40 of the podcast. Thanks again to Jürgen and Travis from RE Squared Robotics for joining us on the program today. New episodes of The Robot Report podcast drop each week. We're on Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, SoundCloud, Spotify, anywhere you get your podcasts. If you haven't already done so, please subscribe, leave us a rating, give us a review, and don't forget to check out our Robo Business Direct series continues this week. We'll be examining services solutions for robotics companies, design, engineering, and manufacturing. Ologic CEO Ted Larson and Zymetica VP of Innovation Joe Gordon will be discussing a variety of services that are available to you for creating and manufacturing robotics technologies and products. They'll also go over provider selection criteria, business models, and service agreement options. To register and to check out the full schedule, just visit robobusinessdirect.com. On behalf of Mike Oitzman, I'm Steve Crow. Take care, everyone. We'll talk to you again next week.